Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to a new episode of Talking About Platforms. My name is Philip Meyer, and today I have with me both of my regular co-hosts, Daniel Trabucchi and Tommaso Buganza. Hey, Daniel. Hey, Tommaso.
Hi. Hi. Hi, everyone.
And we have Erich Joachimsthaler. Hi, Erich. Great to have you.
Hello.
Let me quickly introduce you, Erich. You're the founder and the CEO of Vivaldi, which is one of the largest independent global strategy and business transformation firms with offices all around the globe, US, Europe, Asia. You have conducted lots of research. Before we hit the record button, we talked a bit about it. I spent time at the Harvard Business School, ESA, University of Southern California, among others. And you co-authored multiple books. The most recent one, that's the one that I think will be at the center of our conversation, is the interaction field, which is a super interesting concept closely related to our core topic of the platforms. I think brings a new perspective on the topic, your own perspective on the topic. But before we jump into that, let me hand over to Tommaso to start with our regular opening question.
Great, thank you. Oh yes, we got the regular opening question because in this podcast we interviewed many different scholars and experts of platforms, and one of the things that we easily understood is that there is not such a thing as a common unique definition of what a platform is. So mainly every single one of our guests is bringing inside a different way of looking at it, different perspective, a different so. The first question is, what is your definition? So when we talk about platforms, from your point of view, what are we exactly talking about? And the second question, so I can put the two of them together because we've got two standard questions to open. And the second one is how you ended up starting this. So we've got so many different stories about how people ended up, studying and making research and making innovation on platforms. So what are platforms for you, and how did you end here?
I'm not bothered by many definitions. I've seen this in many areas that people have different definitions for something. But to me, platforms is something that creates value through interactions. That's to me very, very important, because the classic way of creating value for a company is through activities. And value is created through differences in activities. That's what's called a competitive advantage by Porter. I was working with the strategy group at Harvard, and so a Porterian definition is the differences in the activities of the firm produce a certain value, and that value then is delivered to consumers or customers in exchange for a price or something. And to me, platforms in its simplest form is about creating value through interactions. And so then I have my elaborate definition, of course, because I think platforms is a misnomer. It's a name that probably was used from an academic perspective. Even though I think Rocher and Tirol called it multi-sided markets, I think, rather than platforms. But platforms oftentimes is some, there are many technology platforms that are not platforms in the sense of creating interaction. So I call it interaction fields. And the interaction fields have a particular set of components. Number one, they solve a particular intractable problem that is relatively new that cannot be solved through the traditional value chain or pipeline. That's number one. And you know, if it's just you're solving the same problems faster or cheaper, then it's not really worthy, in my opinion, that the pains of platforms or interaction fields. The second is, platforms is about interactions, and I like very much what the work that Jeff Parker and Marshall Van Alstyne talk about, namely that platforms are is about interaction, about governance, and the governance of those interactions, and it's about open systems. And then the third area for me is, when I define interaction fields, is which you call platforms, is that platforms become very powerful and now valuable, or interaction fields, when they cross borders and industry borders. And when you look in classic strategy theory, strategy, when you say the differences in activities of the firm relative to competitors, that's why you do competitor analysis. But in the case of platforms transcend industries, you know, and they make industry borderless almost. So I find it extremely valuable, the fact that platforms or networks that they create value through interactions, they just seamlessly travel across industries and categories, which makes traditional strategic and a strategy and really useless. And because you can't define competitors in the same way, or the competitive set in the same way, and therefore you cannot define competitive advantage in the same way. What I found in my book, what I did, and where I think of platforms more than many others, is that I always look at it as an integrated with pipelines as well, these value chains. I rarely study just pure platforms, because most platforms really are also integrated into pipelines. And in my book, I use John Deere as one example. So for me, those four characteristics, because the platforms in itself, pure platforms, just a pure platform, really the failure rates are so high, the difficulty of building one is so high. I think that they make a lot of sense when they are integrated into a larger value system, and that's why I also call it interaction field. It's an entire field where interactions create value, and of course through network effects and viral effects and learning effects.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting. I think to jump directly into that, and also I like the comment you made with regard to pipelines, meaning like more linear mm-hmm. business models, and then also the platform aspect. If we like try to drill a bit deeper into that aspect, I think you also put a lot of emphasis on customer centricity, and I think this is something that also in the linear business model is of high importance. But thinking about a company like John Deere, maybe as an example, mm-hmm. So how does a company like John Deere enter into a, let's say, interaction field mindset and understand like how's the process to understand, okay, this is the linear business and now I have the opportunity, and how can I tap into this opportunity to also build something like a platform or interaction field business?
Yeah. So great. Thanks very much, Philippe, because the question is such a good question. I can also answer the second question of Tommaso. because I always thought, you know, being born in Germany, where product car industry is dominant and, other companies, I always thought the world is very simple. That you create value on the supply side and then you push it over to the demand side. And I got fascinated with branding, because back then in the 90s, and when I did my doctoral thesis, because I said, like, the most value, I always told this to Michael Porter and the guys at Harvard, you studying the supply side, you studying the pipeline, you studying the value chain, forget it. You need to study the demand side. You need to study customers. You know, you totally ignore customers. You talk about competitors. You guys, you're wrong. You need to talk in the months on customers. The value is created on the when you push the product to the customers. And there's this intangible asset value, the brand, for which people will pay a lot more. Therefore, value is created in that by understanding customers. They, of course, said, you know, you are too young to understand, son. go do your mathematical, statistical mumbo jumbo stuff. And about 10 years ago or more, it really dawned on me that many of the platform people, what they really still talk about is value creation on the supply side. But Marshall Wallerstein and Jeff Parker and others, they always said, you know, the value is created on the demand side, customers and consumers, because there are a lot more of them. So I got totally intrigued by this idea that value is shifting from activities of a firm to interactions, from the supply side to the demand side. That got me to Tommaso's question, why I got into this. That got me excited about that. And with John Deere, when I encountered John Deere in Moline, Illinois, I always was fascinated about this amazing brand and these $800,000 tractors. You know, you can buy two Rolls Royces or three Bentleys or something like that. And the farmer would have to spill out $800,000 for the top of the line model, which is kind of insane given the economics of agriculture. And that's a really great business because John Deere has perfected the pipeline. They did, including the distribution, because the technology is so fancy now on this, so many sensors on it and whatever on a tractor, that in order for you to, if you have a problem as a farmer, you can't repair that anymore on your own. When I was a child, you know, like I was growing up in a little village in Germany, the farmers would repair their own, or the handymen would repair their own tractors. But today, the electronic doesn't work. So they have a perfect lock on the entire value chain, and they're doing a fantastic job in every part of it. And what happened is, the way John Deere got into this was they said to themselves, John Deere also looks at, obviously, the productivity of the farms. And what happens is that at some point in time, was it 2015 or 14, around there, when some people at John Deere realized that the increase in productivity of putting more technology on the tractor is actually incrementally not doing much for farmers. If you are really, really, really good, you can improve the productivity of a farmer maybe by a few percentage points. A few percentage points will not put out of many farmers that are need to be subsidized by the government, you know, into profitable businesses. The answer, however, that became a very compelling story, and to your question, Philippe, got you into platforms and them into platforms, is that then if they could get farmers to share their data, their not only the field data but also the farm profitability data, so operational data in the farms, how much fertilizers they buy, how much does the labor cost, and all of these things. If they could get those data and analyze those data, the productivity improvement could be massive. And it goes back to the beginning that we talked about, the value creation on the demand side. Of course, John Deere created myjohndeere.com. In order to share the data and build a AWS platform, but on the other side, it was the farmers who contributed the data and actually can make use of the data. So I think that the way they got in there is because it just makes common sense. It also helps sell tractors, you know, that helps, you know, in some ways. It's a good talking point, a good talking point. And it doesn't distract, it doesn't cannibalize tractor sales. So I think that's how they got in there. By the very sheer, this idea that if you shift value creation to the demand side, engage with farmers, there are 6 million farms out there. And that's a massive amount of money, people. If there are few suppliers, if you create an ecosystem, if you put a TV screen on there, if you throw in a Netflix subscription so the farmer doesn't get bored when they lumber down the field or something like that, you know, all of that is incremental. That's value creation on the supply side. On the demand side, there are 6 million of them, and in the U.S. and then globally. 40% of entire world is agricultural land. So the idea was that there is enormous value creation if we could create an interaction field that creates shared value. And I think that's a bit of that motivation that came there. In the US at least, the theory was that if you get above a certain amount of, I don't know exactly the number anymore, a certain amount of farmers participating, you would eliminate farm subsidies, which is one of the biggest budgets in the United States government. So it's really cool. And when you project it to 2050, then you can actually eliminate world hunger and things like that. So and John Deere had this idea. We could also give the learnings and the results of the farming from the farmers that participate available to farmers in other countries who are not even participating in it. So it's really a farmer in India can learn from it. Let's say he can't afford an $800,000 tractor yet, but in a few years from now he will. So it was also a way of customer acquisition and establishing a relationship in a sort of a global, almost like a social network for farmers that helps also the selling process. So lots of motivation for John Deere.
Yeah, I think this is a great example because, like, as a quick follow-up question there, based on your work in this case and also in other cases, I think there are sometimes the situation that building a more like platform-based business around the pipeline business, it can be complementary. So it can support in this case the tractor sales, but it can also cannibalize the quote unquote traditional business, right? So how to manage these two? Would you say it should always be complementary and it cannot be cannibalizing, or is it just then another way how to set it up? It cannot be that integrated. How a company tackles these challenges?
I have been asked the questions many times. What I have found with John Deere, going back to that example, is a very interesting one. They, on the My John Deere platform, they say, instead of funding a startup in some distant place that cannot bother the main business and let the main executives do the main business, that what they did is they actually integrate that platform business with a whole larger business. So the advantage was that the data that exists in the main business is actually the startup culture that was built around John Deere. They are not actually just the startup culture that is like some venture fund or some separate organization. It's actually fully integrated in the larger thing because it uses proprietary John Deere data. And that makes the startup actually much more successful. And, you know, the whole story, and the reason why that makes it more successful is because the executives in the legacy business, they cannot ignore what happens on the startup side or on the venture side. They actually, because they need to share data, they are fully vested in the outcome of the thing. So I'm sort of like, the way to make this work is like the way John Deere did it, is that they said, like, we are not keeping this a separate business. This is part of one of the major divisions they had, the technology divisions. And these people are not sent off for 2 years on a venture fund with $100 million or something. We want them to actually innovate and actually innovate on a continuous basis along the main business. And I think that's extremely important because, as you well know, that changes the mindset of the whole company. It doesn't mean it means that people need to wrestle with the platform business models. So I don't think the traditional solution that's been written up in HBR and so many places and all the consulting companies recommend, I don't think is a good idea. I think it's almost a romantic dream, but I don't think it's a business reality. But I don't think it works that way. I think it needs to be integrated. You need to hold the manager's feet to the fire, all of them, you know, regardless of success in the legacy business.
You know, Eric, listening to you after reading your book, I see a few dots that I'd like to connect. You know, Tommaso and I come from this platform thinking perspective, so very linked with what Philip was asking about, these established firms going towards platform models and sometimes transforming themselves into platforms, sometimes having platform initiatives next to a linear value chain business. And you started talking a lot about competitive advantage and the role of competitive advantage in this kind of transformation. Then you moved with John Deere mainly on the customer side, so looking at the needs of the customers and going for customer centricity in a certain way. And then Philip was kind of asking, okay, but what about the competition? And these points were pointing to the case of Klöckner in my that was something that when I read the book I was super interested about. So I was wondering if you'd like to share something about that case with our listeners.
You know, I knew of Klöckner and I researched it like crazy until I met Gisbert. If you read in the book, I portrayed how a very, very legacy industry, you know, where things are done on paper and pencil, on a telephone, on a fax. How he said, I'm going to build a industrial platform for steel. And the idea was very, very compelling to me. And then after that, they created that platform. I think it was okay, successful. It streamlined some operations, but he didn't get the volume or the interactions on the platform. If I look in hindsight, the answer was, well, it is probably because it's a Klöckner platform. So let's create XOM, which is a separate platform that is independent, a standalone platform. That one also didn't work very well. There's a lot of reasons why, because of the too incredibly difficult to standardize the interactions. But then I listened to a conversation on a podcast, a fireside chat, between Rita McGrath, the professor at Columbia University, and Gisbert Ryl. And in that podcast, he almost didn't speak about the platform. He spoke about the organizational realities and what it really took. And it was about the time when he was leaving the company, Klöckner. And to me, the real story around Klöckner isn't about what I wrote in the book. I almost was descriptively describing the success in a B2B context. In reality, I think that he spoke a lot more about the management reality and the difficulties. And I think that the story of Klöckner, if you want to get behind the book, what is written in my book, I think it's really about how he, in a legacy business, was able to do what he was doing. So that, and I think you should better, you, the better story, if I may suggest, Daniel, is to look at that podcast, because it is mind-boggling. It was almost like he was on a day. He forgot that he was the CEO just a few days before, but now he was speaking in an open heart the realities of the complexities that he was facing. And I learned so much from the podcast. I almost said, hey, Gisbert, why didn't you tell me that, you know, when you were on the job? You know, it would have improved my chapter so much. There's so many articles written on the technicalities of network effects and two-sided and whatever, all of these things. And I think that the reality is that the challenges really lie much more on the management side, especially in a B2B context that he was.
If I remember correctly, in the book you mentioned that they kind of open not a spin-off, but a kind of separate office.
Yes.
For that initiative.
Yeah.
You know, we both come from an organizational background, so we don't come from strategy, we come from innovation management. And that detail actually got my attention. So I'll definitely go to check out.
Yes.
To know more in that story.
Really, that is in there, Daniel. The story that he goes to with four people, you know, Duisburg, where his head company is, it's very industrial, very coal mining type world. That's where steel is produced. Very, almost, let's call it backward, you know, like many places in Germany are very provincial. And the company is very much like that. But he was a McKinsey consultant. So he's been going around his ways before. And there is a very nice story about him going to Berlin and that I wrote about. But I think that then the real value comes is the challenges he faced in order to make happen what he did back in the home office in Duisburg and translating that back into and bringing them along. And so anyway, but I think that with your interest, Tommaso and Daniel, you definitely will enjoy that.
Well, this is exactly what I was thinking about, because I'm listening to you. I mean, we in many cases, when we talk about platforms, and even today, but in many other chats we had in the podcast and with our colleagues, we all always look at, you know, having different customers, having an interaction game, having the nature effect, cross-site nature effect, you know, zero marginal cost and so on. So in a certain way, And this is, of course, it's fascinating. We all love it. So we are here for that reason. But this is looking at, you know, the mechanisms from outside. So this is what you see from outside. What I'm terribly interested in and curious about is what's happening inside the company. Because, I mean, you said something before, but it was, you know, eye-opening to me. So, you know, at a certain point, you leave the quarter, you know, linear value chain, and you start having different customers. And that means that, you know, that's happening outside, but inside you had the purchasing department. And so now the purchasing department doesn't have, you know, a purchasing activity to do, or not only a purchasing. So now you need to become a service deliverer. And the mindset of somebody looking at you as a customer is completely different from the mindset of somebody looking at you as a provider. The way in which they negotiate. Yeah, the way in which they treat you. So you're making you a favor because they selected you as a provider. No, if I'm the customer, it's me making a favor to you. So you should completely change your attitude. So I'm terribly curious about it, because you had probably a lot of opportunities with your work to look at these metamorphoses from the inside. How hard is it to have this, you know, mindset transformation into the head of people?
Yeah. You know, we are working on in the radiology area right now, for the last 3-4 years now already, on a solution 45 million diagnoses, misdiagnoses happen every year. Their company certifies sonographers and radiologists every year on the, either taking the quality of the taking pictures or on interpreting pictures or diagnosis of pictures and images. And the CEO of the company is a very visionary person. And the whole company at some point in time says, this is the future of radiology and sonography. We will invest in that. And if I were to look at the last 3 years, and Tommaso, you're 100% right. We are dealing upfront with the executive committee, let's say five major people, and then we are dealing with the board, who every 3 months we meet, or 6 months we meet, and we look at the updates. They are mostly doctors, medical doctors, all in the medical community. So there's another challenge of them not knowing a business side the same way like a doctor like you and I would. But what happens is, the first point is, it's almost in the 3-4 years, we are still on agenda. We have actually a prototype. We actually tested in hospitals now, in two hospitals, and then a POC, and then we launch. But if you look at the first point is, we are actually oscillating it over the years, over the 4 years. One is that somebody comes around and says, I think everything is about the blockchain. And then the you're trying to keep the project on track, because everybody says, no, we need to be on the blockchain. And it's all about de-identification, because in the healthcare sector, you need to be like that. Another situation is, where the CIO, the chief information officer, is not involved in this piece of work, which is more strategic one than what the CIO does. So 6 months later, the CIO will say, I have something on the technology side that is actually very, very important. And then the organization shifts again to that, and it brings it back. Each of the C-level executives, they have a power base, and they can pull things. They are not just the customers, or they're not just providers. That mindset, you know, like, what is my share of this major initiative? How do I lose power in this process, because I am not involved in the most important discussions here? So, and I find the CEO of this particular company incredibly talented, of bringing in over the course of the year the people. I also notice as this 4-year project now evolves, he's also hiring new people that come in and, let's say, work more on the interface with the hospital and how it integrates with, let's say, radiology machines or something. It's almost like managing an orchestra, like a Vivaldi orchestra, if you will, of a constant symphony, managing the four seasons. Because, I mean, that's maybe why we call Vivaldi. but I think that's very much, Tommaso, is really the challenge to orchestrate that the different power players, and how a function, let's say, a CIO or procurement, in the example you made, had a particular power base, and suddenly they are not in control. You know, they need to change their mindset totally of becoming a service rather than a place to go to where they decide the rules of the game.
Eric, it feels like we can talk for another hour or two, but for today we are already slowly approaching the end of our recording session, and we always ask for, like, what's coming next, right? So like two, three years ago, everyone was talking about decentralization and distributed platforms. And then since, I think, this year, it's all about generative AI, but mostly like technology driven. Now you have been talking about the importance of the management and the organization side of things, right? So how would you bring that together? And looking ahead, what is exciting you in the interaction field context right now when you look ahead?
AI makes us more intelligent. It supplements us. And that's there's a lot of reasons why, and we should be getting excited about it. But AI makes also interactions more intelligent. And that's where the power of platforms comes in. If network effects is the value creator, the mechanism of value creation, then AI is a very, very big game changer. You know, I'm old enough to reflect on this current stage of a technical evolution to maybe the internet. When I came to America in 95, and in 95, 96, 97, in the first 5 years, when you talk to an executive, a C-level executive, about the internet, they would laugh at you. They would say, what, to sell books? Are you kidding me? I sell big machines, you know, computers. I work for IBM. I was on the IBM advisory board for 10 years. Big computers, AWS, AS400s, you know, the big servers. And people would ridiculous. You needed to drag C-level executives into the internet, and you would tell this is not just selling about books or groceries or something like that, or web van in those days, or sock puppets and all of these crazy Super Bowl ads. And this is not just about .com. This is affecting your entire business. And C-level executive would laugh at you. They would say, like, yeah, we have an e-commerce, like some junior guy sitting around playing around with e-commerce. This is very different. I've never seen in the last, what happened in the last 18 months or 15 months, how senior executives fully embrace that. I don't know whether it's all good. I think senior executives love it because at the minimum, there is a significant productivity improvement that they expect. That symbol, it's a simple linear game that they can play and says, I give people, I can see it in my own company. Their productivity improvement in consulting is enormous using those tools. And C-level executives, they don't have to understand a lot to make sense out of that. I think, however, people like you and the community that you're part of and I'm part of, we need to work very hard over the years so that the value of these new technologies are in enabling platforms or interaction fields in my world that can solve real world problems. I don't want to be a tree hugger here or sort of some even thinking about circularity. I really think, however, that when you combine these centralization technologies like AI and you bring them together and merge them and converge them with technologies or business models like the platform, then you can really solve many challenges like what we do in the diagnosis of diseases in the radiology side. I see it very positive that these things are integrating. There is a centralization side. It's a land grab that, as we know, it's already been almost like played out to a large degree. The same players that sort of like have consolidated their powers. But I think that there is a lot of room in the world where you live and I live that has a very huge exponential benefit for companies solving real world problems, or at least consumer problems, to do good business rather than. So anyway, that's how I see it. So sorry if I was long-winded.
No worries. It's always good to end on such a positive note with such a good outlook. Thank you so much for your time. It was great to talk to you. We will definitely link the book and also how to reach out to you. I know you're very active on LinkedIn and other platforms in the show notes so that the listeners, if they want to read the book and learn more and touch on many more very exciting examples and dive deeper, that they can and also get in touch. Only thing for me to say is thank you for your time. Always super rich and super inspiring to talk to you, and just the best for all your upcoming work.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.